Welcome to the Classical U podcast. I'm Jesse Hake. I'm the director at Classical U. Classical U is a subsidiary of Classical Academic Press, a curriculum and monograph publishing company. At Classical U, we provide training for teachers and parents interested in learning more about classical education, how to deliver this method in your classrooms, in your homes. I mostly spend time talking with presenters and live learning event guests, and we look forward to sharing more with you as you tune in. Thank you. So you mentioned how this book, your current project, could be kind of an appropriate bookend with Norms, both quirky books serving an audience. The story of Norms we've been talking about a good bit in the course because it is, I've actually really enjoyed kind of having some of the details of it clarified, because it's a fascinating story. You write this quirky book very young, kind of challenging the establishment in education from very deep classical roots, and then it gets a major national award, and all the libraries are buying it because of this award, but then the entire educational establishment sort of entirely ignores it and moves in, you know, very progressive the directions that we've seen. And and then Andrew Kern, a young teacher out of Idaho, part of this little quirky Christian classical renewal, finds it in a library and puts it back on the map for this little crowd of classical educators. And it's just continued to grow and gain appreciation there as your own classical kind of rootedness, you know, your training in philosophy did give you real grounding in classical education, and it's been fun to kind of hear that, learn a little bit more about that story, which I already knew. I'll take a quick moment, and you can correct me as you've had a delightful career, and I'll just run through a little bit of it myself, because I wish I could ask questions about it, all of it, but again, go here, look up some of the course content. There's going to be delightful stories. But after the Rhodes Scholarship, period of study in Moscow, service in the Navy, teaching at the War College, and surprise and crazy story running for Congress that was sort of handed, asked of you, and remarkable stories there. And then the bulk of your career after all of that, heading multiple schools, and which you're still on boards, and a school in Portugal that's just amazing to see the pictures of, on seminary boards. So really, although you've kind of hidden away here in Montana, still serving educational ventures around the world, but a tough career of turning some schools around and taking a lot of things head on, and taking a lot of criticism. And in the course of all of that, translating with your brother Scott Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, and giving it the title The Emperor's Handbook, which is another kind of surprise runaway success, and also writing some curriculum with Andrew Curran's organization Circe, Plutarch's Lives, and adapting some of those into curricular materials for contemporary schools. So a lot of different ventures and work. I'm hoping to drag one more story out of you. I just caught wind of the fact that a very prominent contemporary political figure, Ron DeSantis, was hired by you as a teacher, and you said that he took some heat from the New York Times during his year serving in your school. Is there any story I can drag out of you a little bit there?
Well, there's no story about Ron. I mean, he was fresh out of Yale, as I recall, and he taught history and coached the baseball team. He was a popular teacher, very nice guy. You know, I think my wife and I had dinner with him a few times in the school dining room, and he was always pleasant and intelligent, very, very interested in history, very curious about things, and I liked him a lot. And I was sorry he left us after only 1 year, but obviously he had bigger fish to fry. I think he went from Darlington to law school, if I'm not mistaken. He's if you look at his life, he's an achiever, an overachiever, really, a real scrappy guy who, and appears to have a lot of courage and a lot of integrity. The only story I get, someone sent me a copy of the New York Times sort of hit piece on him a few weeks ago, and I read it, and I mean, I if I were a journalist for the Times, I would have just been so ashamed of, I mean, why the editor ever let that story leave her desk or his desk. I mean, clearly it was just for a political motive, because they tried to find someone who would say something. Obviously, they were looking for someone who would say something negative about him. And the two or three people who had kind of weird negative things to say, that was most of the article. And then they ended it with a couple of very positive stories of people who clearly knew him well, but very brief comments. And I'll give you just one example from the article. And you can look at the New York Times article, and you may or may not agree with me, but they found, and these are young people, I mean, these were people being quoted who hadn't seen him for 20 years. I mean, they were in school 20 years ago, and they were just kids, right? And, you know, not that a kid can't have a point of view, but they're remembering something from a long time ago and interpreting things through the lens of their experience since then. None of the people who comment negatively appeared to know him very well. They didn't play in his baseball team. One little girl who identified herself as a black girl said, well, I never had Mr. DeSantis in class, and I never really spoke to him, but I know he looked down on me because of my race. Well, you know, she may feel that way. I mean, I'm not saying I'm sorry she feels that way, because she's basing her feelings entirely on her own probably current views of the terrible wokishness we're going through, right? I am certain that Ron DeSantis, you know, coming out of Yale, being the young guy he was, didn't look down on her because of her race. He may not have looked at her at all because she wasn't a student of his and never had conversation with him. I mean, it's a pretty big school. And maybe she felt that he should have paid some attention to her and she had her feelings hurt. I don't know. But the fact that the New York Times would quote someone, particularly a black girl, who never had a class from him, never spoke to him, but wanted to go on record as saying, I'm sure he looked down on me because of my race.
It's a rather bizarre level of desperation.
I mean, what kind of journalism is that? It's like talking to someone on the street who, you know, doesn't know you, has never spoken to you, but
I'll share an opinion.
Yeah, I've got an opinion about him just the same. Yeah. Of course, maybe that's, it's sadly, it is just a picture of our times. And that's why we should go back to the Butunyev book, right? I mean, the only identifier, at least we as Christians, the only identity that we really need to own is identity as sinners. The rest of it just gets us into trouble. You know, if I identify, you know, furthermore, there are certain things. I mean, do you really want a person who identifies by the color of their skin is already digging a hole for themselves? I mean, I would never want to identify myself as a white man. No, I'm happy to be a man. I'm happy to be white. I mean, but if I were black and a woman, I would be happy to be black and I would be happy to be a woman. I mean, I think I touch on this in our book, in my book, The Wall, too, that I've never met anybody who wasn't, you know, who would give up their sacred self to be someone else. No matter how, you know, I used Bill Gates as an example. I said, yeah, we can say, I'd love to have Bill Gates' money. I'd love to have his brains. I'd love to have his lifestyle, whatever else. But if you really push came to shove and they said, well, would you give up yourself, who you are, and become Bill Gates' self? I don't know many people. I certainly wouldn't do that. I don't know many people who would do. They say, yeah, give me his money, but I want to keep myself, right? And let Bill be Bill. I mean, I don't want to take his self away from him either. And I think that's true for most people, even if people are rather humble or rather, you know, have a difficult life. Yeah, they'd like to have the life someone else has, you know, the yacht, the car, the whatever they, you know, I'm bald, I want hair, you know, whatever those things are. But they're not willing to trade in their sacred self for someone else's. And I mean, the whole identity thing is really hurting this country deeply. And it's making some people, you know, when I say I'm happy to be white, I mean, it's the way I'm created. So anything, any way I'm created, you know, I'm fairly short. Oh yeah, I'd love to be tall, but no, no. I mean, would I trade who I am, me, to be 6 inches taller? No. Never, not on your life. And so we're just, you know, we've really missed the whole thing. We're judging ourselves very superficially. And the other problem with that is it's making us, in my view, a nation of ingrates. You know, we should be thanking God for everything he's given us, even if it's not a lot. What we have, even in our nation, in our eyes, to see the beauty around us, in our neighbors, to see the beauty in others around us. We should be just thanking constantly God for that. And we should be trying to unearth that sacred image in ourselves instead of burying it with all of our stupid theories and ideas. But we're not, and we're turning into a nation of ingrates, and there's nothing worse. I mean, even the pagans were not ingrates, you know.
As Marcus Aurelius demonstrates.
No, Marcus Aurelius, I mean, they may have worshipped their ancestors. They praised their ancestors. They thought their ancestors were demigods or whatever. But they were thankful for the world as they came into it. They were thankful for life. They were thankful to their mothers, to their fathers. They had this deep sense, this well of gratitude for it, which is one of the things I think that makes classical civilization attractive to us. They were proud of their city. They were grateful for their city, their towns, their polises, whatever. And we're mired in ingratitude, and it's ugly. It's just really ugly. And it takes us, it's not taking us anywhere.
The Marcus Aurelius' The Emperor's Handbook, your translation with your brother, that was one of, I read it recently in preparation for coming here and enjoyed it tremendously. And one of the things that really strikes, I think, anyone who would read it is that he doesn't have his own identity in his status as an emperor.
No.
You can't read that and not realize that this is a man who identifies himself in some far deeper, more interior, you know, way. Kind of like Augustine says, you know, you're of God, you're higher than my highest and deeper than my deepest. But Marcus Aurelius is, you know, maybe you could say, if he's playing the identity game at all, it's as a Stoic philosopher, you know, but it's really his own sense of what he owes to himself as a human being that really seems to, you know, he keeps calling himself out as a human. And he's not fixated on, he takes seriously his responsibilities as an emperor, but that's not how he identifies.
Well, so, he wouldn't use the term sinner to describe himself.
No.
But when you think about it in pagan terms, that's what he describes himself
yeah.
as.
Yeah.
He is, I mean, the book is a piece of literary self-flagellation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he is eager to point out every flaw in himself
mm-hmm.
and deal with it unsparingly.
Mm-hmm.
And he sees himself as a failed human who is working to become
yeah.
a successful human.
Yeah.
And yeah.
But he seems to hold himself accountable because of something about human dignity,
mm-hmm.
you know, that is mm-hmm. dignified. So yeah, I'm failed and I'm self-flagellating because I know who I truly am
yeah.
as a human being yeah. in this astounding cosmos.
There's so, always yeah. an idea of perfection behind that. Of course,
yeah.
pardon me, but that is one of the core ideas of the you talk about classical,
mm-hmm.
you talk about
mm-hmm.
that is a core idea of the ancient world. This idea, held this idea of, look at their statues, look at their temples.
Mm-hmm.
They were all striving to draw the perfect circle
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
they believed that the circle was perfect. They believed that there were perfect, you know, that the heavens were
yeah.
moving in perfect directions. They had this idea of perfection, which they applied to themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And by the way, the Christians just took that over.
Yeah.
Be perfect as I am perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, do you think we have now an idea of perfection?
In Jesus Christ.
Yes, it's Jesus Christ. But I mean, in our secular world,
no.
is there an idea of perfection?
It's utterly, utterly abandoned and ridiculed.
Yes. Yeah. We're yeah. cynical about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, yeah, that's yeah. right.
Well, let me ask this one last question. You know, I'm here with a company, Classical Academic Press, and one of our subsidiaries, Classical U, working on coursework for Classical U. And you wrote a book that a while later was very inspirational to the classical educational renewal that some of us like to talk about among homeschools, public charter schools, some faith-based, you know, independent schools. And what would you have to say regarding the all of these wide variety of different types of schools, you know, as a retired school leader who wrote a book as a young, you know, very young man that became inspirational to us all about the classical education, the value of it for homeschools and you know, a wide variety of other faith-based and even public schools. What are some hopes, some directions, just kind of in bird's yeah. eye view mode, you know, that you might pass along as a challenge or encouragement?
There's a part of me that's flattered by the attention and flattered by the fact that it's still in print and people think it's an important book. So let's just get that out of the way and say, you know, that is true and I have to deal with that. More seriously, you know, when I wrote the book, and I say this in the book in several places, particularly the second section, which was the practical section of the mm-hmm. book, I was hoping, I wanted to offer some very specific advice about what would now be described as a sort of interdisciplinary approach, which I really strongly believe in, and which I tried to install in my, so that aspect of it I tried to encourage in the schools I headed. Saying that, I never intended people to look at that and say, oh, that's what we need to teach.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just was giving examples of these are the kinds of questions, the kind mm-hmm. of texts, the kind of work that mm-hmm. I think would be healthy or would at least reflect a classical tradition.
Yeah.
You know, a Roman teacher from the second century could come back and look at that curriculum and say, oh, well, I don't recognize those books, but yes, that's
mm-hmm.
that's a classical approach. And the focus of the book was on two things, really, conscience and style,
mm-hmm.
which are kind of weird words, I suppose, but conscience, a style pertains to beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you want teachers, children to see beauty all around them, to understand what beauty is, to try to recreate beauty in their lives and to graduate from your school with a really a great appreciation for beauty and for and for and wanting to see beauty. I mean, we started talking about the house and the land. Yeah. I mean, to go back to the house for a second, I didn't really care. I wanted to build a beautiful house. If it didn't function well as a house, so what? I mean, it didn't function well for me. If it was beautiful, that would be the most important thing to me. After that, yes, I would like to, you know, I'd like to have a net zero house in terms of energy usage. There are a lot of things I would hope to achieve. And that's that 2 years, by the way, of thought exercise. I mean, to be honest, most of it was an effort after creating a beautiful space to do in the space what needed to be done to make it habitable in this climate, in this place, and work for Betsy and me and our friends and our guests who family that come to visit. In the Renaissance, when they didn't really have architects, but they had builders. And when you went to a builder like Palladio, for example, who did a lot of these houses, he didn't sit down like a modern architect with you and sort of get to know the members of your family and what your lifestyle was like and, you know, what kind of games you played and whether you needed a television in every room or whether you blah, 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 right? He had one question for you. How many rooms do you want? Okay. And you said, well, I want 7 rooms. Fine. I'll design a house with 7 rooms for you. What was he thinking? And what was the person asking for 7 rooms thinking? They were thinking, I want something really beautiful. Mm-hmm. And because motives are also mixed, they're also thinking, I want something that's really going to impress my neighbors. Because my neighbor here in Venice just put up this palazzo, you know, 3 miles from where my rural land is. Mm-hmm. And I want my house to be bigger and better and more beautiful than his house. These are Italians. Obviously, that's going to be a big, a motive because they're human beings. But my point is that education, I hope what the book does is first it really focuses, gets back on a focus, what is beautiful, and lets children really just experience the beautiful things in nature, in art, in music, because frankly, in the culture, they are surrounded by garbage.
Yeah.
Garbage. On television, it's garbage. And I've often said this, you walk into the MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art, you ask curator there, well, show me, I want to see beauty. Mm-hmm. They look at you like, are you crazy? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not beauty. This is self-expression. This is whatever
political statement.
It's a political statement. It's an abstraction. I mean, the reason I love modern art, and I do like some modern art, to me, it's a very honest depiction of our culture. Mm-hmm. It's just a mess.
Yeah.
And it's so self-indulgent. It's so arrogant. And the best of it is just playful. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's my personal view. I know people are going to jump all over me for it. And the people who pay millions of dollars for it, I mean, fine. It just makes me laugh. But it probably is worth what the money is worth. But and then the other is conscience. Mm-hmm. Conscience is embracing the fact we live in a moral universe, that there is good and bad, that there's a right way to do things and a wrong way to do things. You know, that there are norms. That's the book got its title from that, Norms and Nobility. And schools traditionally were about teaching children what the norms are. Mm-hmm. And norms are also manners. I mean, William Wickham said, manners maketh man. Mm-hmm. I mean, how we treat one another, the elegance in life, the grace in life, which also morphs into beauty. That's what's beautiful, you know? Mm-hmm. When you meet a person, when I met my wife, she was not just beautiful to look at, but she had a beautiful manner of speaking, of engaging the people around her, of everything, setting a table, preparing a meal, dressing. You know, you could name all the things that were just so graceful and beautiful about her. She had learned the right way to do things. And, you know, she didn't pick her nose in public, and she didn't, you know, eat her food with her hands and do those kinds of things. She wasn't wearing tattoos all over her face. I mean, you name it, right? Didn't dye her hair purple. And, and I, you know, I know that sounds very, you know, people, that's very judgmental. Yeah, norms. You're making judgments about things. And I don't want to force people to adopt, you know, norms that are pleasant to others. Benjamin Franklin said in Poor Richard's Almanac something I think that's kind of fun. He said, you know, you eat to please yourself, you dress to please others. I don't think, you know, one of the things about a civilization is the extent to which we do things, the purpose of which isn't to please ourselves, but it's to please those around us. That there's a very kind of unselfish quality to really civilized people, and to really Christian people, I might add, because these things are very tightly, you know, we were a Christian civilization, and children were raised to want to do things that please those around them. Mm-hmm. Now it's, you know, I want to do what pleases me, right? Mm-hmm. And how, if anyone takes offense to that, well, that's their problem. And, you know, we're all so stuck on our own rights. There was a last kind of point I'll make here is an Italian political philosopher named Joseph Mazzini. He was Garibaldi's kind of theoretical philosopher, whatever. But he wrote a book called The Duties of Man. Mm-hmm. Good book. Every high school student should read The Duties of Man. But he starts off in the book, I'm paraphrasing very generally, but he says, everybody these days is talking about the rights of man. Everywhere I go, rights of man, rights of man. Well, I'm going to write a book about the duties of man for one simple reason, and that is that if men, speaking of men and women generally, if they don't know what their duties are and they don't do their duties, no one will have rights. Because my rights ultimately depend on the people around me doing their duties. Mm-hmm. And that's just the hard truth. Mm-hmm. And I think we've come into a society or a time when we're all talking about rights, rights, rights. I have these rights, I have those rights. But the reality is we're not going to, any of us have rights if we don't focus on what our duties are. And traditionally, education, classical education, you didn't spend a lot of time teaching children in Athens, here are your rights. Mm. That probably was not even a thought, right? Mm-hmm. Let me tell you what your duties are as a citizen of Athens, mm-hmm. right? You're going to have all these duties, and you've got to prepare yourself to perform these duties. And the nice thing about Athens, by the way, was one of your duties was you are going to grow up to become a legislator in this city. Mm. Everyone, the judges, the generals, everyone is chosen by lot, randomly. Forget this voting business, right? So everybody has to be prepared to do those jobs, mm-hmm. do those roles. Mm-hmm. So you best get a great education. You're preparing yourself for that. Well, that's kind of my little chapter in Norms, the ennobling of the masses. That's what we should be doing. That's what a classical education, some people ask, you know, well, a classical education isn't for everybody. It's just for the, you know, the elite, like those, the boys who went to the English public schools, right?
Right.
And that, no, in the ancient world, yes, it was for all the citizens. I mean, there were a lot of slaves and they didn't get an education. Girls did not typically get an education, which is unfortunate. But if girls are if women are going to have an equal role in a democracy, they need a classical education. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a no-brainer to me mm-hmm. that every one of us should be prepared. I mean, we are electing, here I'll digress very briefly into the area of politics, which I hate to talk about, but look at what our choices are. I mean, we are electing fools to government. And I don't care what your politics are or who, you know, it's embarrassing to be an American and hear what often comes out of the mouths of our leaders, see the issues they get into, know that, you know, if you want to go to Congress, it's probably the quickest way to get rich. It's shocking. And my view is that that's a reflection of how well American people are educated. We accept those kinds of, flawed and embarrassing leaders because we don't know any better, because, mm-hmm. We don't ask the right questions. We're not critical. We don't care about norms. Mm-hmm. We can elect somebody who's morally reprehensible, terrible mm-hmm. behavior, because it doesn't matter to us.
Yeah.
So, yes, that's classical education. And I think if we had not departed from a more classical approach to education really 100 years ago, and we were still focusing on conscience and style with young people, we would have a much different country today.
You pray for the day we can find
our
way back.
That's norms and nobility. That's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, David. It's
pleasure.
Been a privilege. I enjoyed these days of working are just delightful, and this conversation was also delightful. So thanks so much.
Well, thank you for being such a wonderful guest. You much better behaved than the suitors in Ithaca.
A tough challenge to improve upon.
Thank you. Good.
Thank you so much for listening to the Classical U podcast. Please do check out our website, classicalu.com, and our teacher magazine, Altum. We hope you've enjoyed these conversations with presenters and live learning event hosts with Classical U.